Thank you for being an amazing supporter of the 10X Podcast Group, home to the history of the Caribbeans. We're excited to have you as a valued member of our growing community. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Your likes, comments, and reviews mean so much to us. They help us reach a wider audience and inspire us to keep sharing these incredible stories. With new episodes released daily, your feedback plays a crucial role in shaping our content and making it even better. Your dedication and enthusiasm drive our mission to document and celebrate the rich history of the Caribbean. We're deeply grateful for your support. Today, we're thrilled to present Honduras Episode 2, a captivating story tracing the journey from the island's earliest settlers to the present day. So sit back, relax, and join us as we guide you through this fascinating chapter in Caribbean history. Enjoy the journey. Chapter 5, The Fall of the Federation and the Birth of a Nation, 1823-1840s. Part 1, A Fragile Dream, The Federal Republic of Central America, 1823-1827. The streets of Tegucigalpa were alive with the sounds of celebration. Church bells rang in triumphant symphonies, echoing through the valleys, while men and women raised their voices in song. The weight of Spanish rule had finally been lifted, and Honduras, along with its Central American neighbors, had stepped into a new era of self-rule. For the first time in history, Honduras was not a colony. It was free, or at least that was the dream. On July 1, 1823, the five nations of Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Costa Rica joined together to form the Federal Republic of Central America. The goal was grand: to unite the newly independent states into a powerful, prosperous federation, much like the United States to the north. But dreams are fragile things. The ink on the Constitution had barely dried before cracks began to appear in the fragile union. Old rivalries, economic struggles, and clashing ideologies threatened to tear it apart before it even had a chance to flourish. The greatest divide was between two opposing visions. The liberals, led by Francisco Morazan, who wanted a strong, unified Central America governed by progressive policies, freedom of the press, separation of church and state, and an end to aristocratic rule. The conservatives, primarily backed by Guatemala's elite, who believed in strong regional governments, close ties with the Catholic Church, and maintaining the power of the landowning class. The ideals of unity and progress quickly gave way to distrust and power struggles. And as the rift between liberals and conservatives deepened, war became inevitable. Part 2, The Rise of Francisco Morazan, the Warrior of Unity, 1827-1830. In the heart of the conflict stood one man, Francisco Morazan. With dark, piercing eyes and a commanding presence, Morazan was more than just a leader. He was a symbol of the Central American dream. Born in Tegucigalpa, Morazan was not a man of privilege. He was self-made, rising from humble beginnings to become one of the most brilliant military minds of his time. He believed in education, democracy, and a united Central America, a federation where all people, regardless of class or race, could build a better future. But his ideals were not welcomed by all. In 1827, the conservatives of Guatemala and Honduras, backed by the powerful Catholic Church, launched a coup against the liberal government in Honduras. With Spanish influence still lingering and old colonial powers refusing to release their grip, Morazan was forced to flee to exile. But he did not stay gone for long. By 1829, he returned, leading a fierce rebellion against the conservative forces. Town by town, battle by battle, he liberated Honduras, then El Salvador, then Guatemala, marching triumphantly into Guatemala City. In 1830, he was elected president of the Federal Republic of Central America. For a brief moment, the dream of unity seemed alive. But shadows loomed over the federation. Morazan had won the battle, but he was about to lose the war. Part 3, The Fall of the Federation, A Nation Divided, 1830-1838. Power is a dangerous thing. Morazan's vision of a progressive, united Central America angered many. The church, which had long held control over education, land, and political influence, saw his policies as a direct attack. The wealthy elites, who had grown accustomed to power, plotted in secret to bring him down. Across the Federation, revolts erupted. In Nicaragua, conservative forces called for secession. In Guatemala, the aristocracy turned against Morazan, branding him a tyrant. In Honduras, old political enemies plotted his downfall. By 1837, The situation worsened when a deadly cholera epidemic swept across the land, killing thousands and further destabilizing the fragile federation. As fear spread, so did propaganda. The conservatives blamed Morazan, accusing him of bringing death and ruin. In 1838, under immense political pressure, the Federal Republic of Central America collapsed. One by one, the five nations withdrew from the Union, reclaiming their individual independence. And Honduras, once part of a grand dream, was now alone. Part 4, The Execution of Morazan, The Death of a Visionary, 1842. Morazan refused to give up. Even as the Federation crumbled, he believed that Central America could still be saved. In 1842, he made one final attempt to restore the Union, gathering an army of loyal followers and launching a last campaign to reunite the region. But the world had moved on. Betrayed by former allies, Morazan was captured in Costa Rica. His enemies, fearing his influence even in death, sentenced him to execution by firing squad. On September 15, 1842, ironically, the anniversary of Central American independence, Francisco Morazan stood before his executioners. With his head held high, he refused a blindfold. "I die, but my love for liberty shall never perish." The shots rang out. And with Morazan, the dream of a united Central America died as well. Part 5, The Birth of Honduras, A Nation in Turmoil, 1840s and Beyond. With the collapse of the Federation, Honduras was finally an independent nation. But independence came at a cost. The years that followed were marked by instability, as Honduras struggled to define what kind of country it would be. The conservatives, now in power, sought to restore old colonial traditions. The liberals, still reeling from Morazan's death, fought to preserve his vision. The indigenous and Afro-Honduran populations, who had long been marginalized, continued to resist Spanish-style oppression. Throughout the 1840s, Honduras saw revolts, civil wars, and political assassinations. Presidents came and went, but true stability remained out of reach. Even as the nation grew, ghosts of the past still lingered. The shadow of Spain, the memory of the fallen federation, the dream of what could have been. And yet, Honduras endured. Through war, through betrayal, through hardship, the people of Honduras held on. They were no longer just a former colony. They were something new. A nation. A people. A future still waiting to be written. Chapter 6. The Banana Republic, Foreign Influence and Economic Exploitation, 1850s-1920s. Part 1. The Rise of the Banana Empire, A Nation Sold, 1850s-1870s. The sun rose over the Caribbean coast of Honduras, bathing the land in a golden glow. The air was thick with the scent of damp earth and salt, a reminder of the lush, fertile land that stretched beyond the jungles and into the valleys. But the land no longer belonged to the people of Honduras. By the mid-19th century, Honduras had fought its wars, shed its blood, and finally emerged as an independent nation. But independence did not mean freedom, not from the forces that lurked just beyond its borders. As Europe and the United States expanded their economic reach, Central America became a battleground for foreign interests. The great colonial empires of Spain and Britain were gone, but a new kind of empire was rising. One built not on armies, but on corporations. And Honduras, with its vast fertile lands, was ripe for exploitation. The banana, an exotic fruit in high demand across the United States and Europe, had become the gold of the tropics. By the 1870s, American companies began buying up land, securing exclusive trade deals with the Honduran government, and establishing plantations along the northern coast. What began as small-scale trade soon grew into a monopoly, controlled by a handful of foreign businessmen. And so, Honduras was no longer ruled by its own people. It was ruled by the banana barons. Part 2. The Rise of the Fruit Companies, The United States Takes Control, 1880s-1900s. By the 1880s, Honduras was no longer just a nation. It was a company town, and the companies were American. The United Fruit Company and Standard Fruit Company, two of the largest and most powerful corporations in the Western Hemisphere, established a firm grip on Honduran soil. They did not come with guns. They did not come with warships. They came with money, and they bought everything. They bought land, entire regions sold for pennies to foreign businessmen. They bought railroads, ensuring that no Honduran farmer could transport goods without their approval. They bought politicians, controlling who ruled Honduras with bribes and backdoor deals. In return for this control, the companies built roads, railways, and ports, not for the people but for their own exports. The Honduran economy, once diverse and growing, became dependent on a single product, bananas. By 1900, Honduras had earned a new name, the Banana Republic. It was not a title of pride. It was a warning. Part 3, The Exploitation of the People, Slavery by Another Name, 1890s-1910s. The great banana plantations stretched for miles, their fields teeming with workers from sunrise to sunset. The majority were Hondurans, forced to labor under brutal conditions. Others were Garifuna and indigenous laborers, who had been displaced from their ancestral lands and left with no other choice but to work for the American companies. The pay was pitiful. The hours were endless. The punishment for resistance was swift. Company overseers, often foreigners loyal to the fruit companies, ruled the plantations with iron fists. Workers who protested were fired, blacklisted, or worse. But the worst of it was the contracts. To the outside world, the fruit companies provided jobs. But in reality, they enslaved the nation, not through chains, but through economic dependence. Honduran farmers could not sell their crops without company approval. Local businesses could not thrive without company contracts. Even the government could not function without company investments. The companies built company towns, where the people lived in company-owned houses, shopped in company-owned stores, and used company-issued money. Honduras had become a nation of workers, ruled not by presidents, but by foreign businessmen. And as their profits soared, Honduras sank deeper into debt. Part 4, The First Labor Strikes, The People Fight Back, 1910s-1920s. By 1910, the people of Honduras had begun to see the truth. They were not free. They were not independent. They were slaves in their own land. And so, the first labor strikes began. In 1912, banana workers in Tila refused to work until they were paid a fair wage. The companies responded by firing them all. In 1916, dock workers in La Ceiba organized protests against the dangerous conditions in the shipping ports. The military was called in to crush the movement. By 1920, the first Honduran labor unions were formed, secretly at first, for fear of company retaliation. But the companies were watching. And the United States government was watching, too. Washington had no intention of losing control over one of its most profitable colonies. And so the next phase of the Banana Republic began, a phase where Honduran presidents were no longer elected by the people, but chosen by the companies. Any leader who opposed American interests was removed. And if the people resisted too strongly, the U.S. Marines were waiting offshore. Honduras, once again, was a nation under foreign rule. Not by Spain, not by Mexico, but by corporate America. Part 5, A Nation in Chains, The Shadow of the Banana Republic, 1920s and beyond. By 1925, Honduras was one of the most exploited and corrupt nations in Latin America. The economy was owned by foreign companies. The government was controlled by American money. The people were trapped in a cycle of poverty. And yet, resistance continued to grow. Even as the banana barons tightened their grip, the workers fought back. Even as the government crushed protests, the voices of revolution refused to be silenced. The seeds of change had been planted. But Honduras was still far from freedom. The world was about to change again. And when it did, the people of Honduras would be ready. For the Banana Republic could not last forever. And one day, the chains would break. Chapter 7, Revolutions and Political Instability, 1920s-1950s. Part 1, The Boiling Point, The Rise of Dissent, 1920s-1930s. The early morning air over the northern coast of Honduras was thick with the scent of sweat, salt, and soil. The plantations stretched far beyond the horizon. Endless rows of banana trees standing like silent witnesses to the decades of suffering that had unfolded beneath them. The United Fruit Company and Standard Fruit Company ruled this land like kings, their power greater than any elected official, their reach extending far beyond the fields and into the halls of government. But the people were changing. They had watched as their fathers and grandfathers were worked to death for pennies. They had heard the promises of reform, only to see the corrupt politicians silence their voices. They had felt the weight of foreign rule, as U.S. corporations turned their homeland into a playground of exploitation. And now, they were ready to fight back. In 1920, the first major labor strikes began. The banana workers, once too afraid to resist, had reached their limit. In La Ceiba, thousands of workers refused to step onto the plantations demanding better wages, shorter hours, and humane treatment. In Tila, entire villages stood in defiance, blocking company shipments and crippling production. In Trujillo, a new movement began to rise, one that whispered of revolution. For the first time in decades, the people of Honduras had hope. But hope was dangerous, and the men in power had no intention of letting it grow. Part 2. The Dictatorship of Tiburcio Carias Andino, 1933-1949. The Iron Fist. When Tiburcio Carias Andino took office in 1933, he promised peace. But what he delivered was fear. Carias, a staunch conservative, aligned himself with the United Fruit Company and the U.S. government, securing their support in exchange for keeping Honduras under corporate control. Under his rule, labor unions were outlawed. Opposition leaders were imprisoned or disappeared. The military was strengthened, becoming the personal enforcers of the ruling elite. The United States praised him. They called him a stabilizing force, a leader who would protect American business interests and keep Honduras from falling into communist hands. But to the people of Honduras, he was something else entirely. He was a tyrant. For 16 long years, Carias ruled with an iron fist, his secret police silencing anyone who dared speak of resistance. But no dictatorship lasts forever, and Honduras was growing restless. Part 3. The 1944 Uprising, the People Strike Back. The breaking point came in 1944. Across Latin America, dictators were falling. In Guatemala, the people had risen up and overthrown their oppressive regime. In El Salvador, revolutionaries had begun to fight for democracy. And in Honduras, the people were watching. The streets of Tegucigalpa, San Pedro Sula, and La Ceiba filled with protesters, their voices calling for an end to dictatorship. For the first time in years, the people were not afraid. University students led marches, defying military curfews. Workers refused to harvest the banana fields, shutting down production. Dissidents in exile returned, rallying the people to fight for democracy. The Carias regime responded with violence. Protesters were gunned down in the streets. Labor leaders were arrested, tortured, or executed. But the fire of resistance had been lit, and soon the flames would spread. Part 4. The Fall of Carias and the Fragile Hope of Democracy, 1949-1954. By 1949, Tiburcio Carias Andino could no longer hold back the tide. Under immense domestic and international pressure, he finally stepped down, handing power to his hand-picked successor, Juan Manuel Galvez. Galvez, though still aligned with the corporate elite, attempted limited reforms. He allowed for the formation of labor unions, giving workers the legal right to strike. For the first time in decades, the people of Honduras felt hope. But that hope was short-lived, because the true test of Honduras' future had yet to come. And in 1954, the battle would begin again. Part 5. The Great Banana Strike of 1954, A Nation Rises. In 1954, the streets of Honduras trembled under the weight of history. It started with a whisper, a rumor of revolution spreading among the banana workers of Tila and La Ceiba. Then came the first walkouts, then the factory closures, and then the entire country erupted. More than 25,000 workers left their jobs demanding higher wages, better working conditions, an end to corporate rule. For 69 days, the workers stood strong, paralyzing the banana industry and sending shockwaves across Latin America. The U.S. government, fearing communist influence, closely watched the unrest. The Honduran government, pressured by the fruit companies, tried to crush the movement. But this time, the people refused to be silenced. For the first time in history, the fruit companies were forced to negotiate. The strike ended with major victories for the workers: higher wages, better conditions, and the right to form independent labor unions. But even as they celebrated, a new danger loomed on the horizon. Because in the United States, powerful men were watching. And they were not pleased. Part 6. The Cold War Begins, The Shadow of the U.S., 1950s and beyond. By the late 1950s, Honduras was caught in a new kind of war. Not a war of guns, but a war of ideology. The United States, now fully engaged in the Cold War, saw any resistance to American business interests as a communist threat. And the Honduran elite, still deeply connected to U.S. corporations, welcomed American intervention. The result? Workers who pushed for greater rights were labeled as communists and arrested. The Honduran military grew in power, funded and trained by the U.S. to suppress subversive elements. New alliances were forged, not with the people, but with foreign governments and multinational corporations. Honduras had won a battle. But the war for true independence was far from over. And in the decades to come, the country would become a battlefield once again. Chapter 8. The Cold War and Military Coups, 1950s-1980s. Part 1. The Cold War comes to Honduras, 1950s-1960s. A nation on the chessboard. The air was thick with fear, though no battle had been fought, no war declared. Honduras, a nation that had spent decades under the thumb of foreign corporations and corrupt politicians, now found itself trapped in a conflict not of its own making. The Cold War, a struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union, was not fought with armies on Honduran soil. No, the war came in whispers, in secret deals, in bribes and betrayals. To Washington, Honduras was not a country. It was a pawn, a strategic piece on the chessboard of global power. The United Fruit Company still ruled the economy. The U.S. Embassy still dictated policy. And the Honduran military was no longer just a national force. It had become an arm of American influence, trained, funded, and controlled from afar. The people, who had once dreamed of true independence, now found themselves living in a puppet state. And as the world changed, Honduras remained shackled to the past. Part 2. The Rise of the Military Dictatorships, 1960s-1970s. In 1963, democracy in Honduras came to an abrupt end. President Ramon Valeda Morales, a moderate reformist, had dared to challenge the power of the elite. He had proposed land reforms, fought for workers' rights, and begun the process of modernizing the country. But he made one fatal mistake. He was seen as too soft on communism. To the United States, this was unacceptable. With Washington's silent approval, the Honduran military staged a coup, overthrowing Valeda Morales and replacing him with Colonel Oswaldo López Arellano. The message was clear. Honduras would remain a military-controlled state. The new junta government immediately suspended civil liberties, banned labor strikes, cracked down on leftist movements, strengthened ties with the U.S. military. For the next two decades, Honduras would be ruled by generals, not presidents. And anyone who spoke out, journalists, students, union leaders, would be met with violence. Part 3. The Shadows of War, Honduras and the Dirty Conflicts of Central America, 1970s-1980s. By the 1970s, Honduras had become a base of operations for U.S. interests in the region. In Nicaragua, the Sandinistas had overthrown the U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship, replacing it with a socialist government. In El Salvador, a brutal civil war was raging, with leftist rebels fighting against U.S.-backed death squads. In Guatemala, indigenous communities were being massacred under the guise of anti-communism. Honduras, geographically positioned in the heart of the storm, became the staging ground for America's war against socialism in Central America. The U.S. poured millions of dollars into the Honduran military, transforming it into the strongest armed force in the region. But this came at a terrible cost. The Honduran military, under U.S. guidance, launched its own war against dissent. Secret police hunted down suspected leftists. Labor organizers vanished overnight. Student activists were tortured in military prisons. And in the jungles of Honduras, hidden from the world, something even darker was happening. Part 4. The Contras and the Hidden War, 1980s. Honduras as a proxy battlefield. The 1980s were the bloodiest years in Central American history. The U.S., desperate to contain communism, used Honduras as a staging ground for the Contras, a paramilitary force trained, armed, and funded by Washington to fight against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. Their mission? Destabilize Nicaragua. Destroy the revolution. Stop socialism from spreading. But there was a problem. The Contras were not just soldiers. They were mercenaries. They were assassins. They killed indiscriminately, targeting not just Nicaraguan forces, but Honduran civilians suspected of sympathizing with leftist ideals. The Honduran countryside became a war zone, filled with hidden training camps, black operations, and CIA agents who worked in the shadows. And for the Honduran people, the nightmare only deepened. Part 5, Battalion 316, The Death Squad of Honduras. Of all the horrors of the Cold War in Honduras, none were as feared as Battalion 316. This elite death squad, trained by CIA operatives and Argentine military advisors, was tasked with one goal: eliminate political dissent. They carried out torture operations in hidden prisons, targeted assassinations of journalists, activists, and union leaders, disappearances where victims were kidnapped, tortured, and never seen again. By the late 1980s, hundreds of Honduran citizens had vanished, their names erased from public records, their bodies never found. And all of it was done with U.S. support. The Reagan administration, obsessed with preventing another Cuba or Nicaragua, turned a blind eye to the atrocities. To Washington, Honduras was a model ally, a nation that did what it was told, no matter the cost. Part 6. The Fall of the Military Regime and the Return of Civilian Rule, 1980s, 1990s. But even the most brutal regimes cannot last forever. By the late 1980s, international pressure was mounting. Human rights organizations exposed the crimes of the Honduran government. The American press began to report on the atrocities. And at home, Hondurans had had enough. In 1982, the military allowed for a civilian government to return, though true power remained with the generals. But the years that followed were filled with scandals, corruption, and economic collapse. And by 1990, the U.S. had shifted its focus elsewhere. The Cold War was ending. The Soviet Union was falling apart. And suddenly, Honduras was no longer a priority. Without American backing, the Honduran military lost its grip. And in 1998, the last remnants of the military dictatorship were dismantled. But the scars remained. Honduras had spent decades under the shadow of Cold War violence. It had been used, manipulated, and discarded. And though the generals had stepped aside, the damage was done. Honduras had entered the 1990s as a broken nation, burdened with poverty, corruption, and an uncertain future. The military was no longer in power. But in the shadows, a new enemy was rising. Drug cartels, organized crime, the remnants of Cold War violence, twisted into something even darker. And in the decades to come, Honduras would once again find itself fighting for survival.